I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Journalists are often said to follow a story where it leads. The idea is that you may not know the end from the beginning, so you must pursue the details and just see where they take you. Well, this is markedly different from the process of animal migration, where the path or journey is set from the beginning, instinctually. An animal migrates from one location to a distant destination and the place of arrival. If you can survive the trip, the ordeal, well, it's a foregone conclusion. One such animal arrived in Alaska one day in the year 2010 after an epic journey of 3,500 miles from where she had been tagged 5 months earlier in Tallahassee, Florida. This was a female rufous hummingbird, a creature weighing at best about 3.5 grams. And her story is part of a much larger story told by someone who, unlike a migratory bird, was able to choose where he wanted to journey, not predetermined by instinct, in pursuit of hummingbirds. And he covered a decent amount of territory to do just that. John Dunn actually has been as far north as the regions of the Arctic and as far south as Tierra del Fuego, all in order to see where the story would take him. The hummingbird story, that is. And in the end, he has titled his story, The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. John Dunn is a natural history writer, a photographer, and a wildlife tour guide based in the Shetland Islands. And it's a pleasure to have him on the line with us. John Dunn, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Marcus, it's great to be on the show. Thanks ever so much for inviting me to join you.
Yeah, this is a journey of yours that, did I overstate the case, from almost from pole to pole?
No, you certainly didn't overstate the case. And in fact, my journey began at 60 degrees north here in the Shetland Islands. And the first point of my path intersecting that of a hummingbird was at 60 degrees north in Alaska. So, as you rightly said, I made something of a migration myself.
Yeah, your hummingbird story, I understand, though, began many, many years ago before you ever thought about doing a book like this. There's something you saw. And it turned into a bit of an obsession, I think.
Yeah, this is the, you have to place yourself back in the 1980s in the 10-year-old shoes of a young boy living in the southwest of England. And I was a kid who was obsessed with the natural world. I loved nothing more than being out in the countryside looking for whatever I could find. And I was obsessed with color as well. I liked bright, colorful things. So butterflies, wildflowers, in particular orchids, and some birds. But you have to understand that a lot of the birds in Britain aren't as colourful as the birds you guys have there in the United States. So our warblers, for example, are drab and brown and not a great deal to look at. And one day, my mum took me to London on a day trip, and this was to do all the usual tourist things. You know, she wanted me to see the red buses, the black cabs, Buckingham Palace, all of that stuff. But she also knew that if she was to make the day out worth it for me, she had to take me to the Natural History Museum. And that was the part of the day I looked forward to the most. But what I wasn't expecting was to come across a glass cabinet in a corridor in the museum. And inside it were hundreds of taxidermied hummingbirds. Now, that sounds really kind of bleak and macabre, I know, but I'd never seen birds like them before. And in a shaft of sunlight, their plumage blazed with color. They had the most gorgeous iridescence in the remarkable metallic colors I just didn't expect to see on birds, let alone birds with such amazing shaped tails and long sickle-shaped wings, and some had crests. And it, you know, I was blown away, and that was the seed planted for an obsession which was to consume me until eventually I got to the United States and saw my very first hummingbird, and then I was lost to them.
Well, you know, I have seen paintings, replications of paintings by Audubon of hummingbirds from some of the most remote areas. And some of these birds almost look like caricatures. They look almost clownish with crazy feathers. And, you know, the hummingbirds I've seen are not nearly as intricate. They're just simple hummingbirds. They don't have those long, ornate plumes.
Yeah, I mean, hummingbirds are, as you said, are found throughout the Americas, from Alaska in the north to Tierra del Fuego in the south. And at those sort of extremes, the colder climates, hummingbirds are pretty functional. They're fairly straightforward, conventional birds with a little stubby bill, and they hover and do all the stuff we expect a hummingbird to do. But they're existing at the limits of what's possible for hummingbirds. But in the more tropical areas nearer to the equator, and in particularly in the Andes, they have evolved. They've had full scope to evolve magnificently and wildly to occupy really specific niches of habitat. And some birds are evolved particularly to pollinate or to feed from, and hence pollinate particular flowers. So, for example, heliconias, which are these wonderful flowers which have waxy sort of yellow and red bracts, and they're sort of claw shaped. I think they're also known as dragon claws in florists. There is a particular hummingbird, the sicklebill, which has a bill which looks almost deformed. It's so bent like a sickle, but that fits exactly into a heliconia flower so that the hummingbird can access the nectar within. And they're like, there's another species, the sword-billed hummingbird, which has a bill longer than its body, which looks utterly impractical. I mean, how do you preen or feed your young with a bill like that? But the point of that is to feed in really long trumpet-shaped flowers. So yeah, they some of them do look outlandish, but it's an absolute miracle and manifestation of evolution that they've come to look that way.
So what has your main motivation been? Has it been to see the breadth of the different species, from the fantastical to the more simple humdrum type of hummingbird? Or are you in pursuit of any particular species or locations?
Well, there's a little bit of everything going on there. I am a birder. You know, I'm a naturalist generally, but I would be lying if I said that there wasn't a part of me which didn't want to see the very rarest species, the ones which get a birder's pulse quickening. So, for example, in Peru, there's something called the marvelous spatule tail. And this is that's one of the things. Hummingbirds, a lot of them have really cool names like that. but it's a case of, yes, it's a marvelous bird, and it kind of does what it says on the tin. It has this amazing long tail with a disc on the end of each tail feather, which is the spatule. So, and that's only found in one particular river valley in northern Peru. And so, yeah, there were rare ones like that. And another one found out on an island, Isla Robinson Crusoe, off the coast of Chile in the Pacific Ocean, and found there and nowhere else on Earth. So there were some which I wanted to see because they're both rare and in really romantic locations that are redolent of all sorts of stuff. That island in particular, for example, was where in the 18th century, a Scottish sailor, Alexander Selkirk, was cast away for 4 years by the crew of an English boat that he was the navigator on. He fell out with the captain and he was left there with just his Bible and some basic equipment and provisions. And he survived. And he hid from Spanish sailors who landed on the island at various points. And of course, the Spanish and English were great enemies at the time. And eventually he was rescued by another English vessel 4 years later. And when he came back to Britain, he told his story, and it came to the attention of Daniel Defoe. And Defoe wrote the book Robinson Crusoe. And I love that stuff, not just as a naturalist, but as a writer. I love stories. I love colourful stories. And so part of my journey to see the hummingbirds was also looking for really great human stories, historical ones, and always where our world intersected with that of the hummingbirds. So hummingbirds have a fabulous, rich cultural history. Their native peoples have revered them from time immemorial to the present day, when they appear in literature. Some of the great names like Dickens and D.H. Lawrence, Pablo Neruda, have written inspired by hummingbirds. So I loved all this stuff. So I wanted to dive deep into their world. But also, I just wanted to see the most remarkable birds, like the bee hummingbird in Cuba, the smallest bird in the world. And some of the most beautiful birds in the world are hummingbirds, things like the velvet purple coronet I mean, the name alone is gorgeous, but the bird itself, it looks, it's like a rich royal purple. It's iridescent. It's absolutely jaw-dropping.
How difficult is it to get to Robinson Crusoe's island?
Yeah, it's not that straightforward, and especially not when you're living in an island, a remote island group in the first place. When I was here in Shetland, trying to work out the logistics of getting to Robinson Crusoe was not straightforward. I speak some Spanish, which helped, but the island is serviced by a Chilean naval vessel, which goes every now and again. And I really wanted to turn up on that. The romantic in me wanted to arrive like Alexander Selkirk did on a boat. But the practicality of that was a little difficult to organize. So I caught a plane, and, well, I'm a bit of a spoiler from the book here, but we got halfway on the 3 or so hour journey out to the island, and then just turned back because the island had been enveloped in a bank of fog. And of course, you're flying into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You can't just go out there and hope that it's going to be cleared by the time you get there. So they just had to immediately abandon the flight. We got back to the South American mainland, landed, and the islanders who were trying to get home, who were on the same flight as me, they were all really pessimistic. They said, "Oh, that's it. We're going to be stuck here for days now." And all of our luggage was loaded off the plane, and we were told to get a coffee while that was happening. And no sooner had our bags been put onto the tarmac outside the window than the captain came back in and said, "Right, come on, we're going again. The fog's cleared." And so we're back on the plane. So you'd think that getting to a desert island, I mean, they're famously easy to get onto and difficult to get off of, aren't they? But for me, the difficulty was actually getting there in the first place.
Well, listen, you didn't go to Robinson Crusoe's island just to hang in a hammock and read a little Defoe. You actually were looking for a specific bird. Which hummingbird?
I went there to see the Juan Fernandez firecrown, and that is a bird found only on there are three islands in the Juan Fernandez archipelago, one of which is Isla Robinson Crusoe, and that bird is only found on that particular island, which makes it, you know, sound like the island's probably covered in them, but actually there's only one pocket of greenery on the island. A lot of the island is kind of your classic desert island. It looks like a moonscape. It's a very volcanic island. And in that one corner that's fertile and green, a lot of the sort of original endemic vegetation is gone. The island has been inhabited for a long time now by man, and mankind brought its usual handmaidens with it. And so sheep and goats and horses and cows, and then things like rabbits as well. So there's a lot of grazing, a lot of herbivores on there, which were knocking back the native vegetation. And it's kind of a parable or a metaphor for our stewardship of a lot of the world. If we're honest, it's not uniquely bad on the island. They also introduced eucalyptus trees at some point in the past, and brambles, which are smothering the ground, the understory, and also plenty of predatory mammals. And that is a particular problem for the hummingbirds. There are rats, both kinds, black and brown. There are mice. There are feral and domestic cats. At some point, some bright spark decided to introduce Coatim mundi from the South American mainland, which are a kind of an omnivorous and very tenacious mammal. And so the hummingbirds are up against it. And I went there thinking there were about 1,000 of these birds left on the island. This is what I'd read. This was the official statistic. And while I was there, I met a conservation team who are based on the island. They work for a fantastic NGO called Oikonos, and they're tasked with trying to conserve and improve the habitat that's left. And I spoke to one of the guys there and said, you know, 1,000 birds, you know, how are they doing? And he just laughed and said, there's not 1,000. We count the nests every breeding season. There's 400 of these hummingbirds left. And in 20 years, who knows? They may be extinct. And that was a really humbling moment because, you know, a lot of the book is about joy and wonder and the pleasure that these birds bring to me, but also to the people who live in the places in which they're found. But to look a bird in the eye one-to-one and know that it could be extinct within my lifetime, that was really chastening.
Yeah. And there's an elegy in there. If in fact this bird is headed for demise, I'm wondering about the name of this bird. You say the fire crown?
Yes.
That's got to be descriptive of its head, I'm thinking.
Totally. Yes. Yes, it is. It's not a misnomer at all. There's a lot of hummingbirds have names which do describe exactly how they look. Although, I mean, fire crown does the bird no justice. The male, the whole bird is a beautiful, deep, burnt orange. And the crown, sure enough, has a particular iridescence. When the sunlight or light catches it at just the right angle, the whole head blazes with a sort of amazing golden shield. It's fantastic. But, I mean, all male and female hummingbirds, they're sexually dimorphic. They look different to one another. And usually the female is very drab. She's usually shades of green and white and grey, with maybe just a hint of colour. But on that particular island, the female of the Juan Fernandez firecrown is, if anything, more beautiful and striking than the male. And indeed, for decades, until as recently as the 1980s, biologists thought they were two totally different species because they looked so staggeringly different to one another. The female has a beautiful snow-white breast, but it's spangled with spots of ultramarine and beautiful sapphire blue. She's an astonishing-looking bird in her own right. Arguably, for my money, she's more beautiful than the male, and that's unusual with hummingbirds.
So, John, you're a photographer. What do you do when you come face-to-face with a firecrown? Do you say, hold still, I want just right there, I want that blazing crown of gold. Don't move. Oh. What do you do?
Once I stop shaking. So it's really exciting when you see one of these birds for the first time. But yeah, once I stop shaking, photographing hummingbirds isn't as difficult as some wild animals and birds, because when they're not feeding, and when they feed, you know, they're pretty obvious. They're hovering there, you know, they're doing what we expect a hummingbird to do. But when they're not feeding, they like to find a perch, and they're creatures of habit. And so they'll often return to the same perch time after they've fed. And so, yes, some people who take photos of hummingbirds have really elaborate flash rigs and all sorts of gear. That's not my cup of tea. I prefer to be a lot more unobtrusive and to work with natural light. And so for me, it's a case of studying the birds, looking at their behavior and working out where they go to perch after they've fed, and then try and find a window in the vegetation to frame the bird. So, no, it's not as difficult as some birds, which are much more mobile and elusive. I was asked this the other day. You know, how many photos do you take to get an image you're happy with? Honestly, thousands. The amount of duff pictures I take, which have got a bit of a twig or a leaf in the way. So I'm a naturalist first and foremost. I'm a writer. I love to tell stories, but I'm a photographer. It's like kind of like a third string. It's not the main thing.
Well, as a writer, we are going to put your writing skills or your speaking skills to the test here in just a moment, because I want to get into the anatomy of the hummingbird. And this is going to have to be very descriptive. In just a moment, get ready. We're going to take a short break, but get ready to tell us about the hummingbird tongue, if you can even describe that for a radio audience. John Dunn is with us. He's author of The Glitter in the Green in Search of Hummingbirds. We'll be right back with more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have John Dunn with us. He's a nature writer, a photographer, and a wildlife tour guide. He's in the Shetland Islands, connected with us, and he's author of The Glitter in the Green in Search of Hummingbirds. Boy, is he obsessed with these creatures and has been just almost the globe over to pursue them and to learn about them, to see them. John, I wanted you to talk about the tongue of the hummingbird, because this is just some contraption.
It certainly is, Marcus. It's, I mean, hummingbirds, their bodies are are remarkable. You run out of superlatives to describe what makes up a hummingbird. They have almost twice the muscle mass devoted to powering their wings. Their hearts beat faster than any other bird, up to 1,000 beats per minute. And so the list of superlatives to describe their adaptations to their lifestyle is endless. But the tongues, even by hummingbird standards, are quite remarkable. If you see a hummingbird feeding at a flower, you'll sometimes see that tongue, or a hummingbird feeder in particular, you'll see that tongue darting out of the bill, and it looks filamentous and really fine. Early biologists who got their hands on a hummingbird specimens looked at the tongues, and they could see a kind of a groove running the length of that very long tongue. And they surmised that perhaps the birds were feeding by a capillary action. They were dipping their tongue into the nectar within a flower, and it was being passively drawn into the bird's tongue, and therefore into the bird. But I mean, when you think about it, that doesn't really make much sense. Nectar is kind of thick, gloopy, syrupy stuff, and for the time, the fleeting instant that a hummingbird's tongue is buried in a flower, there shouldn't be enough time for capillary action to deal with that and to draw the nectar in. And I love this because there are still things which we're learning about hummingbirds all the time. And a few years ago, some scientists decided they were concerned about this hypothesis of the capillary action. So they set up a hummingbird feeder with a transparent side, and they set up high-speed cameras to film a hummingbird feeding at this transparent feeder. And when they slowed the footage down, what they saw was absolutely amazing. Sure enough, in went the tongue. And when they zoomed in, what they realized was happening was the length of the tongue itself unfolded. And along the edge of the tongue, tiny little flaps opened up. So the tongue itself bloomed when it was submerged in liquid. And as the tongue was drawn back into the hummingbird's bill and into its head, the flaps and the tongue folded closed again. And what is actually happening, the hummingbird is in effect feeding passively, because as the tongue is drawn back in, all that nectar is trapped within the tongue. And as the tongue is pushed back out into the flower, all of the trapped nectar is forced back into the hummingbird's throat. So all the hummingbird has to do is just dip its tongue in and out of the nectar, and the nectar is passively drawn within it. So far more remarkable than the simple capillary action. And I kind of love, as a writer and a romantic, the symmetry here of a hummingbird visiting blooms to feed from. And when it does so, its very tongue blooms in the process.
You also describe where this tongue is situated within the skull of the bird. This is stunning.
Yeah. So, I mean, a hummingbird's tongue is a long thing. And again, if you look at a hummingbird feeding, it's extended beyond the tip of the bill itself. So all that tongue has to go somewhere. And again, this is kind of the nitty-gritty stuff which takes some dissection to see, but the tongue actually is coiled inside the skull and has to be withdrawn. It actually goes up almost around the eye sockets. So you've got to find somewhere to store a tongue as long as that, and hummingbird evolution has done just that.
Well, we all think of hummingbirds as being rather petite creatures, so it seems like a bit of a paradox to talk about a giant hummingbird. How giant is a giant hummingbird?
I'd love to imagine it was like a sort of Godzilla creature, but it's it's not like that. A giant hummingbird is about 20 centimeters long, and by hummingbird standards, that is big. Now, you guys have, unfortunately, one of our exports there in the United States. You've got European starlings. I think they're pretty much all over.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. It's approximately the size of a starling, to give you a
that's enormous.
That's a big bird. But when we turn that into sort of, you know, hard pounds, it's only 18 to 20 grams in weight. That's not that big. Now, I mean, compare that to the very smallest, to the bee hummingbird. That is just 5 centimeters, 6 centimeters long, and I just love this. It weighs between 1.5 and 2 grams. And that's a mind-bogglingly small amount for anything to weigh. That is less than a cent coin.
Yeah, yeah. So where would I find these two creatures, the giant hummingbird, the bee hummingbird? I think you mentioned Cuba. Did you say Cuba for the bee hummingbird? Or?
Yeah, the bee is in Cuba and only there. And so, yeah, you're gonna need to get yourself to Havana and then head out into the countryside for your bee hummingbird. They're fabulous things. I mean, just smaller than you can possibly imagine a bird will be. And I spent days watching them. There was one particular garden which they were visiting, and it's a famous place to see the bee hummingbirds. And while I was sat there drinking a lovely cup of Cuban coffee and watching these birds, a succession of people turned up to see the bee hummingbird. These were tourists to the island who had made a several hour round trip just to see the bee hummingbird. And it was so interesting to watch the reaction of visitors when they saw these birds, because it must have been how I looked when I first set eyes on one. My jaw dropped. You just can't conceive a bird could be so small. And watching the birds themselves, whenever a dragonfly flew into the garden, the bee hummingbirds just scattered and flew into the cover of trees and bushes, because a dragonfly is bigger than one of these birds. And I mean, dragonflies are very capable aerial predators, and the bee hummingbirds were treating them with a great deal of respect. Now, the giant hummingbird, on the other hand, they're found in South America. They're a little bit more widespread and found throughout a lot of the Andes. They're pretty plain. They're not as beautiful as a great many hummingbirds. They're pretty dull and muted. Giant makes you expect something really spectacular. Nah, go with the little guy. He's far more interesting.
Now, am I completely deluded here, but are hummingbirds really exclusive to the New World, to the North and South America, or do we find them elsewhere?
Well, you're right and you're wrong. If we're talking about the present day, you're absolutely right. They are just found in the Americas and nowhere else on Earth. In every conceivable habitat, to be fair, from deserts, they're found in the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, and equally up above the tree line in the Paramo habitat, just below the snow line in the Andes. So they're found everywhere, and of course all habitats in between: forests, rainforest, cloud forest, jungle, you name it, they're everywhere. But if we go back a few million years, just jump back in time, then there were still hummingbirds. And the oldest known hummingbird fossils which have been found in South America are 1 or 2 million years old, which sounds pretty old. But one day, a few years ago, a German paleontologist was looking at some bird fossils which had been found in a clay pit in Germany. And he realized that the structure of the wings of the morphology of the birds could only be one thing. It was a hummingbird. But the difference was the age of these fossils. They're around 30 million years old, which makes us realize that actually the hummingbirds originally evolved in Europe. And at some point in that 30 million year intervening period, They crossed into the Americas, and once there, of course, you've now got, 300 species found throughout the Americas, more than that, in fact. They obviously diversified and evolved magnificently, but at some point there was an extinction event back here in Europe, and the hummingbirds were lost to us, but happily not to you.
Well, I want to conclude with just whatever wisdom you might want to impart for those of us who care about creatures but perhaps have loved them to death. I don't know if you're an expert on hummingbird care, but certainly there's quite the fad to feed them here with the hummingbird feeders. Not just the feeding. What's your best wisdom for how we should coexist with these animals?
Oh, my goodness. This applies, of course, to everyday lives for everything, not just hummingbirds. We need to tread as lightly as we can upon the earth. If you've got a yard, try and plant nectar-rich flowers. I think the Audubon Society is a really useful resource for looking online to see which particular species do well in particular parts of the US. Yeah, I mean, and this is a win-win for you because you get beautiful flowers in your garden, but you'll attract hummingbirds. A hummingbird feeder is a wonderful thing for attracting hummingbirds to your garden. It's a great resource for a hummingbird to get an easy meal. But of course, you need to maintain them, change the sugar water very regularly, keep them scrupulously clean. Hummingbird feeder hygiene is really important. But if by all means put feeders in your gardens, that's great. But good insect friendly and hummingbird friendly nectar rich plants, that's the way, because there will be other beneficiaries, you know, us to see great beautiful flowers in the garden, but also insects, bees, all of these things really need good nectar bearing plants.
Would you somehow fault me for ending on something that's kind of creepy?
No, not at all. I love the dark stuff.
On YouTube, one can just have incredible fun time if you're a morbid type. I'm talking about the praying mantis, the predation. Yeah. What's that about?
Yeah. Yeah. Hummingbirds are small, and they are a really nice chunk of protein for anything which can catch them, the same as any small bird. Praying mantises don't have any sort of qualms about an easy meal. And you do get praying mantises which are seen staking out hummingbird feeders, and they're there for one reason and one reason only, and that is for a juicy hummingbird. Also, hummingbirds have been recorded trapped in spiders' webs. And again, a spider is not going to turn its nose up, so to speak, at a hummingbird which gets caught in a particularly strong web. And this does happen because, of course, hummingbirds, one of the joyous things about them is they actually use cobweb to bind their nests together. And what that does for a nesting hummingbird, it means that the nest actually has some flexibility and can expand as the young hummingbirds are growing. But harvesting silk from a spider's web, I guess, is a hazardous occupation. And sometimes they do get caught there, too.
Yeah. Well, John, just a delight to get to know you and to learn about your book. I'm wondering if your search is over. I can imagine that it's not.
No. I know we're living in strange times when travel isn't easy. But yeah, the Americas are always calling to me. There's so much to see. And I can't wait to travel again.
Well, John Dunn, thank you so much for spending time with us and for your book. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show, Marcus.
Nature writer, photographer, wildlife tour guide John Dunn, and his book is titled The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. If you're going to live off flower nectar, it helps to have a tiny body, a long mouth for a straw, and really powerful wings. Not coincidentally, that is precisely the equipment shared by hummingbirds and butterflies, two of everyone's favorite creatures on this planet, or at least they ought to be. I actually think I would worry about anyone who is not seriously in awe of both hummingbirds and butterflies. Time for a short break, and when Constant Wonder returns, we're going to speak with a woman who was so enamored with monarch butterflies that she biked all the way from Mexico to Michigan and back again just to follow their migration. Stay tuned. It's great to have you listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our next guest made history when she became the first person to ever trail the entirety of the monarch butterfly migration from the seat of a bicycle. And that's true commitment. Sarah Dykman is an outdoor educator. She's author of Bicycling with Butterflies.
I started in March of 2017 in Michoacán, Mexico, and I finished at the end of November.
And where did
about
you finish?
Nine and a half months.
Did you finish back in Mexico again?
Yep. I started and finished at the same trees, just like the monarchs do.
Yeah, that takes some preparation, and I would imagine it takes some money too. I mean, did you pack light?
I did not pack light on my bicycle. I have a kind of an old steel frame, beat up mountain bike, and I have on the front two bags that I fill with stuff. And on the back, I have two, they're called panniers that I made out of old kitty litter buckets. And they, too, are teeming with stuff. And the whole thing weighed quite a bit, but luckily I can go slow and steady. And with all that stuff on my bike, I was able to camp, which saves lots of money, and able to cook my own food, which saves lots of money. So in the end, it was more about having time than lots and lots of resources.
Was somebody following you along the way, or was this a solo journey?
Well, my joke is it wasn't solo because I was with millions of monarchs. But I was the only cyclist for most of the time.
Yeah, that's impressive. I mean, just the journey itself. But here's a problem that I can anticipate in your storytelling right now. It doesn't seem to me that the butterflies are going to follow the roads.
Yes, I have a story of the first day I am biking down the road, and it is just magnificent. There are literally monarchs streaming by at the exact speed. We're just following the road, and then the road curves, and the monarchs stream into the forest, and I sit there pleading with them, like, wait, monarchs, come back. And, of course, they don't listen. But my route sort of zigzagged, especially in the beginning when the monarchs stick to the mountains. But luckily by Texas, they really start spreading out. And as long as I was on a road in Texas in the spring, I was on the route of the migration.
So were you worried there as you were zigzagging that you would have lost their trail?
Oh, yeah. Especially in the beginning, I thought, what if I don't see a single monarch? And this will be super embarrassing. And I didn't see a monarch for about 3 days after I left the overwintering grounds. And I remember that first monarch. I threw my bike on the ground. I started running after it. I snapped about 1,000 blurry photos for evidence. And I celebrated with what I tell kids is my monarch happy dance, which always slows cars down and gives me a wide berth.
Well, the thing is this. If you're doing this kind of a thing, you're going to hope that they stop at nighttime because you need to stop at nighttime. Do they stop and sleep at night?
Right, yeah. Monarchs don't fly when it's poor weather and at night. Now, I actually do love to bike at night because I love frogs, as you said. And so I'd always be like, yes, I'm making ground. I'm cheating. I'm going faster than them for a moment because in reality, I always tell people I'm faster than a caterpillar but slower than a butterfly.
What did you eat? I mean, you didn't pack it all. You must have stopped along the way for provisions.
Yeah, I try and carry about a day's worth of food. And honestly, I got pretty lazy. I made a lot of sandwiches. I have my classic salad sandwich where instead of having to use a bowl and do dishes, you stack a bunch of lettuce on bread with sunflower seeds and salad dressing, and you got yourself a salad and a sandwich. And luckily, about every few days, I found someone willing to take me in and give me a home-cooked meal. And, of course, I have lots of stories of getting ice cream from strangers all over. So I ate well.
How far into Mexico do you go? How far south do you go of the border in order for your starting place?
I started at the border of Michoacán and the state of Mexico. It took me about 3 weeks, about 1,000 miles of pedaling to reach the U.S.-Mexico border. So it's pretty far south.
And then the border crossing, you just go through a regular border station and show your passport, but that's not where the butterflies are going to be. So you're going to have to kind of chase them too.
I always looked in the sky every time I crossed a border. Monarchs don't cross borders. They cross rivers. They cross mountains. They have no idea that they're going from Mexico into the U.S., they are North American, and I think that's just a beautiful lesson they have to teach us. I always got strange looks at the border, but border agents were always super nice to me and had lots of questions just like everyone else.
Yeah. So by the time you get to the border, actually, that's the Rio Grande, and you're finding yourself with butterflies aplenty because you say they've dispersed by that point. They're not following a mountain range.
Exactly, yeah. They start to spread out when they hit the United States, and the females are looking for their special plant called milkweed, as you described, and that's where they're laying their eggs. And actually, about in Mexico is when that generation that left Mexico, they die, and it's then the next generation that continues the migration. So while I did a round trip, the monarchs actually don't do that. It takes 3 to 5 generations for them to complete that full journey.
The full journey, the round-trip journey, or a one-way trip north?
The full journey. So it takes about 3 generations, typically. It depends on weather, to get to Canada. And then there's going to be the generation born in the fall that flies back. And so I think of that every time I see a monarch in the fall. I think, wow, they are traveling to a place that they're the same place that their great-grandparents, or maybe even great-great-grandparents, were at the winter before. And, like, how amazing is that they can get there and find their way, having never been there and having having no leader to get them there.
Yeah, this is really remarkable because when we think about monarch migration, how often have we heard about the migration without realizing it being a generational thing? I mean, this is, you say, five generations for the whole trip.
It really depends. So if it's a cold season, the eggs develop slower because they are cold-blooded animals. And if it's warm, they can actually get more generations in. So it really depends. But yeah, no one butterfly will make the whole trip.
So the flyway is very broad that you were following. Were you following any particular route that you knew where they would end up in Canada, or how did that work?
The vast majority of monarchs fly basically due north through the Midwest, kind of following the I-35 corridor. And that was sort of my northern route. But, of course, people all across North America, as you said, can find monarchs. And so I really wanted to also spread out. And one thing that is really important to me, and I just think really beautiful, is that I didn't see a monarch every day, but every person I saw along my trip, whether I was in that corridor or not, they are part of the migration. They are on the route of the migration, and they can plant milkweed and help.
Yeah, so you're into that.
I'm so into that, and I loved your story, and I think it's just a testimony to how we all can add up and we can all be part of the solution.
So you see a solution for this. I did share the doom and gloom part of this, that it's not looking good.
It's not. And, you know, people ask me all the time, what was the scariest or hardest part of your trip? And to me, it's just sitting with that information. But of course, for me, if I sit with that, I do get sad and I get depressed, and it's not helpful. So the only way I figured out how to, like, wake up in the morning and celebrate the day is to, like, be part of the solution. And I don't know what the future holds, but I know that at least I can say I tried, and you can say that you tried. And when I was in the Midwest, often I just heard over and over again from people that said, you know, older people that said, when I was a kid, we used to see lots of monarchs. And I just always wanted to ask, what did you do? What did you do to help? And I want to gift the next generation at least my best try.
Do you have any information about the comparative perils for monarchs if it's safer for them coming through Texas than it is coming up, say, through Baja California into California? Are there fewer numbers on the West Coast than there are in the inland?
There's basically two populations, and those populations do mix. So we do have monarchs crossing the Rocky Mountains. But in general, there's the western population that overwinter in California and the eastern population that overwinter in Mexico in general. And they are two distinct populations. They're both facing severe declines. And in general, I think you can attribute those declines in large part to habitat loss and climate change.
Now, habitat loss, this involves, from what I understand from your book, this involves problems of deforestation in Mexico.
It's a problem everywhere. So I tell folks, if Mexico did everything right, if they conserved the forest, if they made sure that not one OML fir tree fell, the monarchs still couldn't make it if the United States and Canada did nothing. So this is another great teaching moment or lesson that the monarchs offer us, is that we are North American and we all have to work together to solve this. So in, like you said, in Mexico, it is an issue of protecting the OML fir forest, which is where the monarchs live. And in the United States, it's about protecting the prairie and offering monarchs milkweed, which is the only plant monarch caterpillars eat, and nectar plants, because they need a lot of nectar to make this migration.
What actually happens if the forests are not there? Is there greater predation? Are they hiding in the woods?
The story of the forest in Mexico is just so amazing to me. So the monarchs fly to these trees, and it happens to be about 10,000 feet above sea level. So it is the perfect temperature of not too hot and not too cold, as well as not too dry and not too humid. Now, the most important thing is to have the canopy of trees, which offer protection from the cold. The canopy acts like a blanket to kind of buffer the most extreme temperatures, and also acts as an umbrella to keep the monarchs dry when there are rain events or snow events. And it's just this really perfect, delicate balance. And when trees are cut, then that offers up a hole in the canopy for cold or rain to enter. And also, like you said, it helps. There are a few predators. There are a few birds that can eat monarchs in Mexico, and it makes it easier for them when there's more holes in the canopy.
Now, speaking of predators that might eat them, the bright orange color is supposed to alarm potential predators and shoo them off, I understand.
Exactly. The monarch orange color basically tells predators, hey, when I was a caterpillar, I ate milkweed. It helps give me this toxic protection. You can try and eat me, but you're not going to like it. So a lot of times you'll see a bite taken out of a wing of a monarch or some sort of like little nibble, and the monarchs can actually escape that. And in doing so, the whatever creature that ate that monarch remembers that, because often they'll throw up, it'll taste really bad, and so they'll see those bright orange monarchs and they'll say, oh, not going to do that again. A lot like humans. That's a story that I've heard with humans, too.
Not that we're biting monarch wings ever, but is it true then that the toxins from the milkweed go right into the butterfly itself?
Yeah, the caterpillars eat the milkweed, which they sequester in their body, and that is what gives them their toxic protection.
Yeah. Now, fascinating to me, this whole business of they fly at different elevations depending on whether they're going north or south.
Yeah, a lot of the determination on how high they're flying, it depends on the wind, and it also depends on what their end goal is. So when they're flying south in the fall, one of their goals is to get as fat as possible. They're one of the few migrants that leaves that begins their migration lighter than when they'll arrive. And their goal is to eat as much nectar as possible, so they're often all day flying near the ground, drinking as much nectar as possible, getting as fat as possible, because when they're hanging in those trees in Mexico, they try and be as inactive as possible, and they're not eating. They're actually just living off the fat reserves for most of the time, which also is a reason why it's so important that forest is the right temperature, because if it's too warm, they become more active, they burn more calories, and they could actually starve.
Well, if the butterflies take off on their migration, is this kind of like a single wave? Are there multiple waves? Is there a vanguard? I mean, how you could lose them if you get too far behind, or are they just, is there like 3 weeks worth of them that stretch over 1,000 miles?
More the latter. So in Mexico, in the end of February, the weather is warming up, and it's just like the most incredible thing to see of the sun will land on the monarch colonies, and they'll open their wings, and they'll kind of erupt into the sky. And on warm days, there'll be more orange in the sky than blue, and you can hear their wings flapping. And every day, starting usually in the beginning of March, some will leave the colonies to go get water. Lots will leave the colonies to get water, but some won't return, and they'll just keep going. So it is a bit of a trickle. There's kind of a main push, but I was probably a little bit behind them, but I didn't notice. It wasn't enough for me to be disappointed or anything like that.
So every single day when you took off, you knew you had to cover how much ground?
My goal was about 60 miles.
Did you say 60 or 16?
60.
Yeah. And was that to keep ahead of them or to catch up with them?
That was just about to stay on pace. I knew I needed to be in Texas in the springtime, and I knew in March and April, and I knew I needed to be up in Minnesota by summer, by June.
So Minnesota is where you ended?
I went through the Upper Peninsula and into southern Ontario. My furthest north position was in Sudbury, Ontario, where I stayed at a wonderful hosts and had a sauna and lots of home cooked meals.
Did your bike break down?
I had a few bicycle issues, but nothing that was that made me stop more than a few minutes or maybe a few hours at the most. My bike is a sturdy machine.
Yeah, how fast can you go on it to keep up with I don't even know how fast these monarchs move.
The monarchs go about the speed, a little faster than me or a little slower, kind of depending on the wind. And my speed, too, is directly affected by the wind. So if it's at my back, I can go fast all day, and if it's going into my face, I could creep along at 4 miles an hour. Really depends. And my goal is always slow and steady. So I tried to go about 60 miles a day, and sometimes that took 6 hours, and sometimes it took more or less, depending.
And then did you just have to wait? I mean, they don't arrive and suddenly turn around and head back. I mean, you've got a month or two?
Right. I never stop moving. The monarchs in the summer will become a little more resident, but I wanted to travel through as much of their range as possible, so I pushed east, and I actually went all the way to the East Coast and followed the East Coast down to New York City, where I saw a monarch, which was really inspirational.
New York City, a monarch?
I did. I saw monarch eggs in a park in Queens, and I saw a monarch male nectaring on a plant in Manhattan. So while all the other tourists are taking pictures of all the skyscrapers and buildings, I was running around taking picture of a monarch.
So was your route, your return route, you didn't follow the same path? You went a different route altogether?
There was a little bit of crossover, but I, again, like I said, I wanted to visit as many places and tell my story to as many people as possible. So I went a little more east on my southern route.
And were there any places along your way where you lost them altogether and found none for maybe a day or two or three?
There were times when I didn't see one for a day or two. Sometimes that was because the weather was bad. I didn't necessarily worry about a day or two. I did worry when I spent a lot of time biking through cornfields, and there was corn all the way to the road, and there was nothing between the plant rows. And all the farmers told me, I used to see lots of monarchs, and now I don't see any. And that weighed on me. But then I would go to a city park, or I'd go to a garden, and immediately I'd find a monarch, which would kind of just re-energize me again. And it just proves, if we give them space, if we share the planet with them, they will come and they will reward us with their story and their beauty.
Sarah Dykman, she's an outdoor educator and author of Bicycling with Butterflies. If the heroes of the U.S. space race had the right stuff, does it follow that the heroes who were our Soviet competitors had the wrong stuff? We never hear much about the Soviet side of that story, but the heroism and drama just as dramatic, and they did get there first. The Yuri Gagarin story, when we return to Constant Wonder right after the news.